This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about a subject dear to my heart, and that's food, maybe diet too, since my 30-year diet isn't going as well as it should be. With me to talk about food, the marketing of food, the power of the food companies, is none other than Marion Nestle, author of, among other books, the award-winning Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. She also has a more recent book out called What to Eat. Marion Nestle is a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, as well as a sociology professor at NYU. And she edited the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. Marion Nestle, welcome to Progressive Radio.
I'm happy to be here, but I have to tell you, it's Nestle, not Nestle.
Nestle.
No relation to the food company.
Very good. I should have asked ahead of time. I didn't do my homework. So, Marion Nestle, how did you first get interested in this field?
Well, I was given a class to teach. I was teaching in the biology department at Brandeis University, and they had a rule that you could only teach the same course for 3 years. I was teaching cell biology, and they said, you will teach a nutrition course, and it was like falling in love.
And so you were doing nutrition then as a biologist?
Yes, I came into it from the science perspective, and my graduate degree is in molecular biology of all things, and it's turned out to be very useful for examining the way nutrition research is interpreted, and it's helped me a lot in issues of credibility.
Were there a lot of women in molecular biology back then?
No, there certainly were not.
So you were a pioneer.
I was a pioneer, but I didn't do it. I had kids very early on, and that ended my research career fairly early.
Was there sexism while you were getting your degree there?
Oh, yes, there certainly was. I had a fellowship when I started, and the graduate advisor said, well, this is a new field, molecular biology. We don't have a lot of men applying for it, and if any men apply, or you're going to lose your fellowship because we'll have to give it to them.
Really? That's about as blatant as you can get.
Yes, well.
But you overcame that.
I did my best.
Tell me how you got assigned to work on that Surgeon General's report back in 1988.
Well, I was teaching at the medical school in San Francisco, and I had one of those crises where I was an associate dean and a new dean came in and I didn't have tenure, and I hadn't published, so I perished, and I needed something else to do. So I went back to school and did a master's in public health nutrition, and then on that basis got recruited to the Department of Health and Human Services to edit the Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. That was during the Reagan administration.
And that may not have been the most hospitable time to be there.
Well, it was a lot more hospitable than it would be now.
Has it gotten a lot worse, do you think?
Oh, much worse.
In what ways?
Well, at the time, it was possible to produce a report like the Surgeon General's report that made recommendations about dietary intake and actually suggested eating less of certain foods and food commodities and products. I don't think it would be possible to do that now.
Just because the companies have so much power.
The companies have so much power, and the agencies are so restricted in what they can do, and there's so much secrecy and control that the staff and the agencies just aren't, they're not permitted to talk to reporters. The processes aren't transparent or open. It's just much more difficult now.
And the Bush-Cheney administration has put in people in these regulatory agencies that are from the industry themselves and hostile to regulation.
Well, that's always been the case, although it just seems more exacerbated now.
Mm-hmm. So this is just a continuation rather than something dramatically new.
Well, it's quantity going into quality, or however they put that. But
now, you mentioned eating less, which is a theme of this book that you say for 5 decades now, really the scientific evidence has been quite clear as to what we need to do about our eating habits. We need to eat less. We need to eat more plants and more fruit.
Yeah, I think the rules of eating are very simple. Eat less, move more, eat fruits and vegetables, and don't eat too much junk food. And that pretty much takes care of it. But the minute you start talking about eating less, you're treading on the toes of the companies that are producing products that you should be eating less of. And that's where politics comes in, and comes in big time.
And so they distort, the companies distort the process of giving people advice.
Well, the companies do several things. First of all, they deny that there's a problem with obesity. They deny that they have anything to do with people's eating habits. They then attack their critics. They produce, they change the way they formulate their products. They lobby. They do all of the things that corporations do when their products are at stake. I actually have a great deal of sympathy for the position that corporations are in these days.
Why is that?
Well, I think that our investment system has placed companies like food companies particularly in a very, very difficult position. Because it isn't only that they have to sell products and make profits. In a situation in which we already have about twice as much food in this country available to the public as anybody actually needs. Let me explain what I mean by that. We have about 3,900 calories a day available in the food supply for every man, woman, and child in the country. That's roughly twice average need. So if you're a food company, you have to sell your product in an extremely overabundant food marketplace. But that's not all you have to do. You have to grow. Wall Street expects publicly traded companies to produce higher and immediate returns to investors. And so food companies not only have to sell product and keep up with inflation and do all of that, their companies have to expand. That's really hard to do when there's twice as much food available as anybody needs. So they need to sell it. They do that by changing society, and they've changed society so that it's become acceptable for kids to drink soft drinks all day long, to have food in vending machines in schools, to have food in bookstores, to have food sold everywhere, for people to eat on the street, for people to eat in cars, for people to snack all day long. These are all huge changes in eating patterns that have only taken place within the last 20 years. Oh, and to eat food in enormous portions.
You're speaking, you're listening to Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of The Progressive. The show is Progressive Radio. My guest is Marion Nessel, author of Food Politics and What to Eat. How can they even deny that there's an obesity problem, though, as a threshold?
Oh, they don't deny that there's an obesity problem. They just think it's a matter of personal responsibility. If you had character, that 30-year diet you've been on would be working better. It's your fault that
you're
it's
killing
not.
Me now.
It's your fault that it's not working. They deny any responsibility for it or any responsibility for creating a food environment that makes the default eating more rather than eating less.
Well, to what extent are they responsible? I mean, this goes back to almost a John Kenneth Galbraith claim about how demand is manufactured, that it's not natural, that people aren't just getting what they want, that the wants themselves are manipulated.
Well, of course, and we haven't even mentioned the idea that there's $36 billion a year that goes into marketing of food and beverages. But that marketing is not only a third of that number, about $12 billion a year, is for direct media advertising, the kind that you can actually look at or notice. The rest of it is for ways that are practically subliminal. It's slotting fees in supermarkets, trade shows, coupon campaigns, T-shirts, and a lot of what goes on the internet and on electronic media that parents are not even aware of but their kids are.
Product placements, too.
Product placements, all of those kinds of things. And the default is to eat more. The default is to have food available everywhere. I love to ask the question, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? You know, I mean, that's just an enormous phenomenon. And now we assume that libraries and bookstores will have food in them. And that's to have food available within anybody's arm reach all day long and all night long.
To what extent do you think people are hardwired biologically? You're a biologist for for food that's fatty and full of sugar and full of salt.
We love it. It tastes wonderful. And when we were out in the fields working for 12 hours a day in the fields, that kind of food was just really good for us. It kept us going. But for those of us who lead incredibly sedentary lives and don't even walk two blocks, but drive a two-block distance, as we just did. Well, it's cold out. We're not spending very many calories in physical activities. We just can't handle that kind of food intake. And we're not talking about a difference of 50 or 100 calories a day. We're talking about a difference of many hundreds.
And one thing that you outline in this book, Marion Nestle, is the fact that the food companies, one way that they're trying to market stuff now is to put, you know, nutritions or supplements or other things into the food that's bad for you to make it a little less bad, or at least to give them something to sell to you for.
Yeah, I call it healthy junk food or healthy appearing junk food. That's the prime strategy for getting people to eat more, not less. Remember, the purpose of food companies is to get you to eat more food, not less food. They don't care if you waste it, but they certainly want you buying it. And one of the ways to do that is to health it up, make it look healthy, even if it isn't. And I have many, many favorite examples.
Well, give me one or two.
Well, anything that's trans fat free, that has a big trans fat free label. I've just come back from California, and there's a donut shop near the University of California campus that has trans fat free donuts. You look at that, you think, gee, they don't have any calories. Yum. I'll eat a dozen.
Glazed, I hope, with chocolate. What is the responsibility of government in regulating these consumption patterns?
Well, I think the government's responsibility is to inform the public about what a healthful diet is. And we have an enormous problem with obesity in this country, and it's not a cosmetic problem. It's raising the risk for type 2 diabetes and other conditions. And it isn't that everybody who is overweight is going to have these problems, but the risk is greater, and there will be healthcare costs associated with that, and also social costs that matter a lot. And so it's government's role to protect the health of its citizens, and in particular to protect the role of to protect the health of its young citizens. And I think that you can argue that adults exercise personal responsibility. One of the great things about being an adult is you get to eat anything you want anytime you want it. But with children, the situation is different. Children, and I think adults should be controlling what children eat.
You talk about the marketing strategy of these big food companies toward children. How have they been able to do that?
Well, they can do that because Congress, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that restriction of marketing violates the First Amendment. Now, my idea of the First Amendment is not protecting the right of food companies to market junk foods to kids, but I think the courts have been interpreting it that way, and the companies take advantage of it. But I think the marketing to kids issue is the point of vulnerability of food companies, and they know it. They've been told that by investment analysts, not just by radical activists like me, but they've been told that by investment analysts, and some of the largest investment firms in the world have warned them that marketing to children is something that they need to be really careful about. And they want to market to children for three reasons. Brand loyalty, they want to get kids to pester their parents. And the most important reason is they want kids to think that they're supposed to be eating food made just for them, not eating the kinds of foods that the boring parents eat. And so they want kids thinking that all food must be sweet or salty in packages with cartoons on it, that sort of thing. And they want kids to think that they know more about what they're supposed to eat than their parents do. In that sense, food marketing to children is extremely subversive of parental authority.
And what about getting the food, junk foods into the schools? How successful have they been at that?
Well, they've been enormously successful. Again, this is something that I think just happened without anybody really noticing or thinking about it. You have to feed kids in school. Kids are going to eat junk food, might as well have the schools making money off of the junk foods that kids are eating. And I think it got completely out of hand before anybody really started paying attention. And now all over the United States, people are going into schools and trying to change the way they're doing it. And trying to get kids fed more healthfully. And there's a lot going on in Wisconsin along those lines.
Some schools now have done local, trying to get as much local produce into the cafeteria and kicked out Coca-Cola or Pepsi that were getting the sole vending contracts. That's been a huge issue, not only here, but around the country.
Well, the wonderful thing about it is that parents can do this on a school-by-school basis, and it's a situation in which grassroots political activity works, and it works really well and makes a difference in kids' lives. Worth doing.
There's one place you can have pressure, at the local school board.
That's
right.
You
may not be able to affect the, you know, Health and Human Services Department in Washington.
Or you can't do anything about climate change, but you can do something about this.
Well, you may be able to do something about climate change locally, but certainly you can't solve it all at once. But you can, in your local school, lobby or go to the PTA meeting, go to the school board meeting and say, why are we giving, you know, Coca-Cola free reign over our kids?
Exactly. And in many schools, and when I wrote Food Politics, people came up and said, you exaggerated. I was just furious about how you exaggerated what was going on in schools. And then I went to my kids' schools. You were understating the situation. I went right down to the principal's office and said, how can we do this? This is terrible. Let's change it. And guess what? They have.
What are some of the things that they've done with the school lunches, for instance?
Well, I think parents can come in and say, we don't want our kids eating junk food, and have real food served to kids. You can make arrangements with local communities and local farmers to produce food that comes into the school system. Even in New York City, which has a formidable problem with schools, they have 1,200 schools, many of them in the poorest neighborhoods in the city, many of them very, very old. They've hired a chef and hired a team of people to try to do something about the quality of the school lunch. And because the system is so large, they're able to pressure the Department of Agriculture to produce better food for the school lunches and to allow them to buy in bulk. It's been very, very impressive. And they're doing it one school at a time.
I mean, the school that I know about up in northern Wisconsin, I think Appleton, where they used organic and locally mm-hmm. produced food, the students actually had better behavior and better performance in their class?
Well, every school that I've been to where the food is better says that. The teachers say the kids behave better. There's less signs of eating disorders among the students. The kids aren't bouncing off the wall at 3 o'clock. They're not as hungry, and they're not as difficult to deal with.
You mentioned eating disorders. Do you go into that in some of your studies, of why there's been this explosion in eating disorders, especially among young women?
Well, it's the flip side of obesity, but it really has other causes. I think the causes are different and really have to do a lot with the image of women in society and issues of control. It's not the area that I most work in, but I'm aware that at New York University, where I teach, eating disorders are the number two cause of students coming into the health center.
What's number one?
Sexually transmitted diseases.
I should know that because I have a friend who is a nurse at the University of Wisconsin Health Center.
And she would probably say exactly the same thing.
I'm sure she might. Now, you talk about food as a social movement, Marion Nestle. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I see everywhere people in communities deciding that they want to do something about their kids' food in schools. They want to do something about marketing to children in general. They want to do something about community food security, create outlets for local farmers, and have a large number of farm-to-community and farm-to-institution movements. These are happening absolutely everywhere. And it's grassroots democracy at its most local. It's of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the most amazing thing when you look at it from a national perspective at how much is going on. And it's the creativity, the number of people who are involved in it, the effectiveness of this movement. Just the idea that you can go into a store and vote with your fork every time you buy food is extremely empowering. It also teaches people who are involved in these things about how corporations work in America and how the political system works. And I think it's enormously useful. It's something that every single individual can do on their own.
I mean, it connects up with Wendell Berry and the writing he's been doing all along about the need for local community control of our agriculture, and taking it away from these huge companies. You mentioned voting with our forks. How do you vote with your fork?
Well, every time you go into a supermarket, you make a decision about the kind of food system you want. You know, if you choose organic, if you choose natural or organic meats, if you choose locally grown foods, if you put pressure on your local supermarkets to engage in the community in a better way, then you're working for a better food system. And that's going to be better for everybody.
Marianne, so how do you respond to people who say, well, look, these huge corporations are taking it over anyway, taking over the organic movement. Walmart's going organic or quasi-organic. Is that a good thing, or are there problems connected with that?
Well, there are going to be problems with all of it. I think the issue with corporations is the way our government was set up in the beginning with checks and balances. And so you need to have checks and balances. Walmart going into organics is extremely complicated. On the one hand, it's wonderful that they're going to create a demand for food that's grown without chemical pesticides, or without certain chemical pesticides, and that's produced under what you hope are going to be better conditions. But it's the hope part of it that I think distresses people, because there's enormous pressure on the organic standards to weaken them. And those pressures come from the large corporations. There's also pressures from food advocates to go beyond the organic standards and to try to create other kinds of certification systems that will have greater meaning about sustainability. I mean, there are holes in the organic standards that you can drive trucks through.
I mean, part of it is a labeling thing, too. I mean, I know that sometimes it's hard to find where some of that organic food is produced. For instance, there's a new Trader Joe's in town, and they have organic milk. But you can't, I searched the carton, figuring out where is this dairy, and there was no mention where the dairy was on the carton that I could find anywhere.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think somebody ought to have a little chat with Trader Joe's about that. You know, Congress, again, in its infinite wisdom, passed laws a few years ago that required country of origin labeling on all food products and then delayed implementation. So the only product that is supposed to have those labels as fish. Nothing else is required to. And I think people want to know where their food comes from. This is part of the movement I'm talking about.
And other countries have standards that are lower than ours on their food. So it's
some do, some don't. Some have higher standards.
Which ones are higher?
So I think if you go to Europe, you find much, much better labeling about where food comes from. And much more information about it. And some stores label pretty well, other stores don't, but there's no uniform requirement for it. And I think that's the kind of thing where you go talk to your local groceries and say, you know, we really want this information. This matters to us.
I mean, a big issue on the labeling was bovine growth hormone, for instance, in milk for a long time. They didn't need to mention it.
They still don't.
I mean, I remember my local co-op. I'm sorry, Marianne Nessel, for interrupting constantly here. Well, I'm going to be scolded when I get home.
You're the interviewer. You get to do that.
That in our local co-op, that they would mark whether there was bovine growth hormone, BGH, in the milk or not. But there was a move, I think, by the dairy companies and food companies to say that it would be illegal even to notify people of that.
Oh, no, the FDA said that. I mean, I was on the FDA advisory committee at the time that bovine growth hormone was approved. I was one of the four consumer representatives who said, you know, not labeling this is a really bad idea. You ought to put labels on it because consumers want to know. And there will be some people who won't buy it because they don't like the idea that it's there. But most people probably will because it'll be cheaper. And that's all a lot of people care about. But that if you don't label it, then you're going to raise suspicion in the eyes of consumers that you're trying to hide something. I think it was an enormous mistake. And the FDA made that rule under pressure from the companies that produce the hormone.
What's it like for you to be on these government committees and you see all the power of these food companies that you write against constantly?
Well, since I wrote Food Politics, I haven't been invited to be on any. I'm considered to be much too biased, which is interesting because people who work for food companies are not.
They're not biased at all.
They're not considered to be biased.
And so are there any consumer representatives?
Yes, there are consumer representatives on all Food and Drug Administration committees. Some of them are more consumer representative than others. But as I say, the invitations have fallen off.
Your persona non grata, no, Maria Nessel. Now, I have to admit I haven't read your latest book, What to Eat. Can you give us a sketch?
Yes, as I can understand why you haven't read it. It's a very big book. That's really meant to be a reference work. What I hope is that people will read the first and last chapters. The first chapter explains what the book is about. The last chapter is an exhortation to activism.
That's usually how I read every book.
Oh, and in between, I've discussed every section of the supermarket. I wrote the book because after I wrote Food Politics, people would come up to me and say, but you didn't tell us what to eat. And I was pretty surprised by that. I think it's pretty obvious what you're supposed to eat: less, move more, fruits and vegetables, no junk food, or not much junk food. But it was clear that there's a great deal of public confusion about it. And so I went through supermarkets, aisle by aisle, and just talked about every single issue that I could think of that anybody might have a question about, and tried to answer those questions. And as I said, it's meant to be a reference work. So if you want to know about dairy products, you look up the chapters on dairy products. You want to know about baby food, there it is.
The book's What to Eat. The author's Marion Nessel, N-E-S-T-L-E. What about the fad diets like Atkins diet? What was your reaction when that came on? Because that's so contrary to what you read about.
Oh, dear. Well, it was a good try. It didn't last long, thank heavens. And I thought, oh, carbohydrates. I don't want to eat a diet that doesn't have any carbohydrates in it. That wouldn't be any fun at all. I like my carbohydrates. But everybody is looking for a quick way to lose weight, and removing whole categories of foods or of nutrients out of the diet, like carbohydrates, seems easier to a lot of people than trying to eat less of everything, when it's really calories that count when it comes to obesity. It's really a matter of calories. And the low carbohydrate was a calorie distractor. It made people think if they didn't eat carbohydrates, they weren't taking in calories. And as soon as they found out that there are plenty of calories in all that meat and cheese that they were eating, and that they weren't losing weight, they stopped going on that diet.
And a lot of people gain their weight right back, too,
yeah,
which is true of almost every diet.
Which is true of every diet.
And why is that? And then how come everyone goes for the next diet when almost all the time people gain their weight
back? Well, because it's a matter of calories, and calories are really hard for people to understand. I have a whole chapter in What to Eat explaining what a calorie is and how you locate them and how you deal with them. I think it's conceptually very, very difficult for people to understand. You can't see them, taste them, or smell them, and there they are lurking in food. And the calorie issue really has to do with portion size. And the idea that food is served in such large portions now is a sufficient explanation for why everybody's gaining weight. Larger portions have more calories. More than that.
There are larger portions everywhere. There's larger portions in the movies when you get those popcorn containers, or even trying to get a cookie. I do like sweets.
So do I.
But to go get a cookie the size of an elephant ear now is, I sometimes go in and I'll buy one of those big cookies that now cost $1.50.
Yeah, that's a 600-calorie cookie.
And I'll try to throw half out, but still.
You know, and for a woman, that's a third of a day's caloric intake, and you don't realize it. The thing about large portions is they not only have more calories, but they encourage people to eat more calories from them, and they encourage people to underestimate the number of calories that they eat from them more than they would if it were a smaller one, so that you have no idea how much you're eating when you have one of those humongous cookies. They go down easily.
They sure do. They're pernicious. We only have about 30 seconds left. Marion Nessel, where can people go for more information on this issue?
Well,
or
I have
to your website.
I have a website, www.foodpolitics.com. In which, you know, I've got stuff about the books, and then I also have posted all the mean things that people have said about me. It's kind of fun.
I have those on my wall at work. Marion Nessel, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. Marion Nessel is the author of Food Politics and What to Eat, among other works. It's been a real pleasure having you.
My pleasure as well.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org.
You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.